Okay, good evening once again. My name is Richard Clem, coming to you live tonight on June 11th, 2015, as part of a conference call. We're going to take a look, kind of short look, at some federal and state legislation on what is popularly called Religious Freedom Restoration Acts around the country. And tonight's program is being offered for CLE credit, both as a conference call and as an on-demand program. During the course of the program, I will be giving a number of code numbers, and I believe I will be giving about three of them. And please write down those numbers and email those to me at the conclusion of the program so that I can record your attendance and send you out a certificate of attendance. If you just stumbled across this program on the internet and wondering what it's all about, you can check out my website at richardclem.com, and it'll show you how you can take this program for CLE credit at a very reasonable price, I should add. Well, anyway, tonight we're going to be talking about some Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, both federal and state legislation. And what prompted me to do this program is that these acts have been in the news considerably in recent months. The I guess the media furors died down a little bit, but what really thrust it into the limelight was when the state of Indiana passed one of these laws a few months ago. And there was, I don't know if you've been on internet discussions at all, there's a lot of, there have been heated discussions about it. I discovered that on both sides of the issue, there was not necessarily a lot of truth. And there were a lot of misconceptions being spread about what that Indiana statute in particular said. So I thought I thought it would be a good opportunity to clear up the subject a little bit. About a year or so ago, I had another program with an outside expert who was talking about the federal legislation along those lines. I thought it would be a good idea to kind of follow up on that with some of the state legislation, not just the Indiana statute that's been in the news, but similar statutes that have been around elsewhere. And I'm going to start tonight just by recapping what the history of some of the federal legislation is, and then we'll move on to some of the state laws. What we're the subject tonight we're talking about, of course, is religious freedom, and as you know, that's a subject covered by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and it's also covered probably by most state constitutions. I know certainly the Minnesota State Constitution actually goes into a lot more detail on the subject than just the general language employed in the U.S. Constitution. But as you know, the First Amendment has two clauses that touch on religion. First of all, there's the Free Exercise Clause, saying that Congress shall pass no law respecting or restricting the free exercise of religion. But there's also the Establishment Clause, saying that Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of any religion. And those two clauses are often in conflict with one another, because in many cases, you know, when you talk about constitutional liberties, it's often possible to, you know, for a government decision maker just to kind of err on the side of caution and say, well, you know, I want to make sure I'm never going to violate the Constitution, so I will always err on the side of caution. You know, free speech, for example, I won't restrict people's speech in any way whatsoever. And, well, you can err on the side of caution as a decision maker and not run any risk of violating that. But when with these two clauses, the two religion clauses, they're often in conflict with one another. So there's really no safe side on which you can err, because there's always the risk that if you err on the side of promoting free exercise, Well, if you're promoting something, you're running the risk of violating the Establishment Clause. Or, on the other hand, if you err on the side of not wanting to violate the Establishment Clause, you might wind up doing things that that cause a violation of the Free Exercise, the Free Exercise Clause. So for that reason, it's a more difficult area of constitutional jurisprudence because oftentimes instead of just being extraordinarily careful, you have to figure out exactly what your responsibilities are. And the courts have grappled with that for many years, recognizing that. That tension between the two clauses of the First Amendment, and there's kind of a pendulum that swings back and forth through the years. Sometimes there's more of a tendency to rule in favor of free exercise, perhaps at the expense of the Establishment Clause. But on the other hand, sometimes the pendulum swings back the other way, and there's an overabundance of caution in not wanting to violate the Establishment Clause, which can perhaps start to run afoul of the Free Exercise Clause. So for that reason, it's kind of an interesting look at you have a lot of interesting cases because there are a lot of issues like that have to be grappled with. And more that swinging pendulum has kind of crept into the work of Congress and of the state legislatures as they grapple with that and discovered on the internet, people hotly debating the issue, even into to public discourse. But the we'll turn the clock back a little bit to a time when the pendulum was swinging maybe a little bit different direction, to 1972, to the Yoder case. That'll be kind of our starting point. The case of Yoder v. Wisconsin, U.S. Supreme Court case from 1972, that arose from the state of Wisconsin. And Wisconsin, like probably every other state in the union, has a law that says kids have to go to school. And I think the Wisconsin statute said that kids have to go to school. Parents have an obligation to send their kids to school until the children are 16 years old or something like that. So it's a law of general applicability. It doesn't say anything whatsoever about religion. It simply says that any child in the state of Wisconsin under the age of 16 has to go to school. Well, Mr. Yoder was an Amish person, and according to his religious beliefs, he thought that education passed a certain point. In his mind and from his religious viewpoint, he thought that schooling, formal public education past the eighth grade would render his children too worldly. And apparently, everybody seemed to agree that that was a legitimately held religious belief on his part, but it was at odds with what the Wisconsin statute had to say, because the children in that particular case were 14 and 15 years old. So the statute said that they had to go to school, but his religious belief said that they did not. Well, the prosecutor filed charges for him violating the compulsory attendance law, and he was fined something like $5. So I kind of got the impression that even the sentencing judge kind of agreed that his religious beliefs were legitimately held. Jail time was available, but he was not sentenced to that. He was just given the fine of $5 per student. Or per non-student, I guess I should say. Well, he took that up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, arguing that that violated the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court disagreed, and he appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with him. They said that even though this was a statute of general applicability that did not talk about the subject of religion at all, still, the state has an obligation to see to it that they are not infringing upon the free exercise of his religion. Which is exactly what they were doing in Mr. Yoder's view, and apparently the Supreme Court's view. He was freely exercising his religion by not sending his 14 and 15-year-old children to school. And they agreed with him, and they held that the free exercise clause was a defense, even though it was otherwise just a statute of general applicability. And that was the state of the law for about 20 years. And as far as I can tell, that case has never been explicitly overruled. So it's, I guess, if you're a parent of 14 and 15-year-olds and you don't believe in public education, I guess that's still a valid precedent. But it has been weakened considerably. And the language is not... not nearly so much in favor of free exercise, because in 1990, the case of Employment Division v. Smith came down. I believe it was an Oregon case. It wasn't a criminal case, but it was Mr. Smith was denied employment benefits because he had violated a state law. So I guess it could have just as easily been a criminal case. But it came up in the posture of him collecting employment benefits. And anyway, the state of Oregon denied him employment benefits because he was violating an Oregon statute. Because he was a Native American and his religious views said that called for the use of peyote in religious rituals. And he argued that just like Mr. Yoder, he was violating the terms of a state law of general applicability, but he was violating that because doing so was part of the free exercise of his religion. Well, in this case, and I don't know if you can really distinguish Yoder from it, but the Supreme Court disagreed with him in that case. They said that it was just an incidental burden to his free exercise, and that was not a violation of the free exercise clause of the Constitution. And they quoted some language from Justice Frankfurter from a 1940 case, which sounds pretty absolute. It says, "The mere possession of religious convictions which contradict the relevant concerns of a political society does not relieve the citizen from the discharge of political responsibilities." So here he had a political responsibility to refrain from the use of peyote, and the mere fact that he had a religious conviction that said he should do that was of no importance, according to the court. He was denied his unemployment benefit. Seemingly in contradiction to the Yoder case, even though, like I say, I don't think Yoder has ever been explicitly overruled. Well, there was this case caused a little bit of a stir back in 1990 because, up until heretofore, we've been dealing with fringe is the right word, but minority religious groups, small religious groups. I don't know many Amish people. I don't know many Native American people who use peyote as part of their spiritual beliefs. But this last case caught the attention of a lot of mainstream or more majority religious groups. Because they took a look at it and said, well, even we as a Christian denomination, even though we're a majority denomination, this language could very well apply to us in activities that we carry out as part of our majority religious viewpoint. And one example that I know came up rather often was, well, sometimes mainstream Christian churches give alcohol to minors. And in most states, there's that's against the law to give alcohol to minors. And some states have an exception written into the statute. And they say it is not a violation of that that alcohol law if it's part of a religious ceremony. And I listed a few of the states that I could find that did have an exception like that. On the other hand, most states, as far as I can tell, do not. And as far as I can tell, Minnesota does not. Minnesota just has a statute saying you can't give alcohol to minors. And it does not go on to say unless it's a small amount of wine given during during a religious service. So that that understandably made a lot of people more in the religious mainstream nervous, looking at that Peyote case and deciding that well, you know, maybe a prosecutor could use the laws of general applicability against them. So there was a little bit of a stir about that, and that resulted in the U.S. Congress acting, because after all, the U.S. Supreme Court had said that you can't that there's no defense for using peyote. So the U.S. Supreme Court said that. The U.S. Congress came along and passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is quoted here in the materials, and it says that would, I think, would cover that communion wine situation, probably cover the peyote situation. It says the government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless there it's in furtherance of a compelling government interest, and it's the least restrictive means of compelling that compelling or of furthering that compelling government interest. With a breath of relief, the persons worried about religious freedom looked at that that federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act and thought to themselves that Congress had saved them from their peril. Well, but unfortunately, the ever since Madison v. Marbury, you know, the when the Supreme Court said that it's the province of the judiciary to decide what the law is, and the U.S. Supreme Court didn't take too kindly to Congress stepping in and basically construing the federal constitution. Even though, to me, it seems like that maybe that's kind of a reasonable use of political power, because you do have two conflicting priorities. So maybe the political process actually is the best way to decide what the best path is between those two conflicting priorities of the Establishment Clause versus the Free Exercise Clause. But the U.S. Supreme Court didn't see it that way. And in 1997, they said that, no, Congress has no authority to construe the U.S. Constitution as it relates to the actions of the individual states. That's strictly the province of the U.S. Supreme Court. And that was the holding in the City of Bern versus Flores case. Well, Congress responded by passing kind of a watered-down version of that. And I'm not going to go into detail just what the differences are, but this was the Religious Liberties and Religious Liberty Land Use Planning and Institutionalized Persons Act, or some moniker to that effect. So a somewhat watered down version of it, and the and more specifically targeting areas where Congress did have constitutional authority to act, and the Supreme Court grudgingly agreed that at least with respect to institutionalized persons, so in other words, an inmate in a prison or something like that, whose fate is directly at the hands of state officials who doesn't have much liberty other than what's granted to them. They grudgingly held that it was constitutional with respect to them. They kind of left open the question of whether or not it's constitutional with respect to the other area over which Congress asserted control, namely land use planning. So, in other words, whether a church can be zoned out of existence or something like that, kind of the extreme case. So that's kind of the federal background, and I guess I don't have to worry about not being able to fill up my 30 minutes because just with that introduction, I used up much of the time. But as I noted, many of these it's really not the province of the U.S. Congress to construe the federal constitution. So as a result of that, a lot of state legislatures stepped in and passed acts that were more or less practically identical in some cases to the federal Religious Liberty Restoration Act or Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA. Number of states passed similar statutes. And I have all of those statutes, or many of them. I don't know if I have a comprehensive list, and I don't know if there might have been some updates from what's posted in the materials. So before you go citing these in court, I guess you better look up your own state statute. But as you can see, most of these statutes follow pretty much the same language of the federal law. They're saying in this state, the government shall not substantially burden anybody's free exercise of religion. I'm quoting from the Florida statute right now because that's the page I have it open to. But they're more or less identical. The government shall not substantially burden a person's free exercise of religion, even if it results from a rule of general applicability, such as a statute saying that you have to send your kids to school or that you can't use peyote. But there's an exception. The government can substantially burden if it's a compelling government interest and there are no less restrictive means available. And most of the statutes also go on to include this next clause or one similar to it. And I guess Florida is a good example. A person whose religious exercise has been burdened in violation of this section may assert that violation as a claim or defense in a judicial proceeding. Some of the states also go on to say that that claim or defense can be asserted in a judicial proceeding, even if the government entity imposing that burden is not a party to the case. So that brings us up to the Indiana statute. And if you flip ahead, that's the one that was in the news. It doesn't differ substantially from any of the other state statutes. It says, a government entity may not substantially burden a free exercise of religion unless there's a compelling state interest and there are no less restrictive means. The Indiana statute says that that can be asserted as a claim or defense in a judicial proceeding, even if that government entity is not a party to the case. So as you can see, that Indiana statute doesn't differ too much from the other state statutes. But as you know, there was as you probably saw, there was a big furor over it. Because the argument was, well, can this be used as a defense to a discrimination charge? And the cases that seem to be popping up involve gay marriage and some service providers such as a florist or a photographer or a baker saying, because of my religious convictions, I do not want to provide services in connection with a same-sex marriage. And the governor of Indiana was chided for not being able to promptly come up with the answer of exactly how that statute would be applied in that kind of case. And the short answer is that I don't know. either how that would be applied, because as you see at the end, and I guess we're almost at our time limit here, so maybe I should have made this a little bit longer program after all. We'll go over here for a few minutes. But if you look at some of the cases construing this, similar state statutes, first of all, your kind of impression, if you just kind of look through this this little digest of cases at the end of the materials, you will conclude that in many cases these state statutes don't provide a lot of added protection to persons asserting religious freedom, because they are a lot of times pretty strictly construed. But the closest case on that that hypothetical that was foisted upon the governor was a New Mexico case, Elaine Photography versus Willick. And the interesting holding in that case, a little bit counterintuitive, I think. We could argue, you know, whether that's an appropriate use of this statute, but that argument was dismissed pretty summarily under the New Mexico statute, because the New Mexico statute, like the Indiana statute, like just about every other statute, says that there has to be action by the government. The New Mexico statute said by a government agency or by a government entity, and most of the statutes including the Indiana one, include similar language to that. Well, the New Mexico Supreme Court, or excuse me, New Mexico Court of Appeal looked at it and said, well, there's no government agency involved here. That was an action by somebody against a photographer under a state human rights act, arguing that they discriminated based upon sexual preference with respect to not wanting to offer photographic services. And that argument was dismissed rather out of hand, because the court said, well, there was no government agency acting here. This was just a private civil lawsuit between two parties. And even in a state where it says that it can be asserted as a claim or a defense, well, there still has to be action by a government agency. So it was not a city council coming in and saying, you have to do this, or it was not a state human rights department. It was simply a civil action between two private parties. And I don't know if that would be the popular the common understanding of the public, that there was no government agency involved, because after all, there was this government agency called a court involved. But the court did not see itself as being a government agency. It saw itself as being a neutral outsider trying to apply the statute. So it seems to me that the Indiana statute, the area where it's gotten so much criticism, the statute does not seem substantially different from this New Mexico statute. I see we are out of time already. You know, and I didn't give any code numbers. So let me give that right now. If you've held on to the end, the code number, just one code number for this program, is I-362, I-362, I-362. Just email me that number at the conclusion of the program. We are out of time. I guess I could talk for a few more minutes here, but if you, what I will do here is I will just unmute the call here, so in case any of you have any questions, feel free to jump in. So do we have any questions or comments before we conclude for the night? Well, hearing none, I will go ahead and